appearing in Las Vegas along with Judge Bonnie Bulla. We're following the COVID-19 protocols and wearing masks on virtually everywhere. In the courtroom in Carson, it's a very large courtroom, and I'm the only one at the bench, so I've dispensed with the mask for the moment. However, in Las Vegas, the judges are right next to each other almost, so they continue to wear the masks. Fortunately, counsel don't have to wear any masks. And that we also want to thank Ms. McFarlane and her law firm for taking on this case pro bono, and also involving a student in the appeal to help argue the case today. We found out in our argument at 11 o'clock that Ms. McFarlane had also worked with the Boyd Law School on that case too. And there were pro bono counsel on both sides. So that was pretty exciting to hear that that program is in play to get students involved in oral arguments too. Judge Tao and Judge Bulla, would you like to make any welcoming comments?
Just, Ms. McFarlane, I know it's your second round of the day, but just to thank all of you for participating in this case, it's a pro bono case, but also for accommodating us and doing this hearing electronically. You know, it's the best accommodation we could come up under the circumstances. It's not ideal. We'd rather have you all here in the courtroom. It just feels more natural that way, but this is the way things are, and this is the best that we can do, and we appreciate you, all of you working with our IT guys and everybody and with Kurt to get this hearing underway.
I would just add to that, we really appreciate you all being here. We know, Judge Tao and I know talking in masks must be a little bit difficult for you all because you can't necessarily, you know, see our facial expressions. But if we somehow don't ask a question that you can understand, or if the mask interferes in any way, let us know, and we'll certainly try to restate the question as clearly as possible. But we do really appreciate you being here and all the hard work that all of you have put in on this case. So thank you very much.
I also want to thank you all for getting your names right on your screens here. The other day I was participating in a Zoom meeting from home on a computer that my daughter had used early in the day. And for the entire meeting, no one told me that under my screen, it actually said Iron Man on it. So we want to thank you for checking your names.
All right. So this case this afternoon is number 80114-COA. It's James Ducey Perry versus Maria Ducey Perry. This is the time set for the argument following the decree of divorce that was entered in the district court in Washoe County. We have for the appellant, Emily McFarlane, assisted by Mr. Cloward, mentioned earlier, student from Boyd. And we have Mr. Fleeman representing Ms. Ducey Perry. And I can see and hear all of you well. And we have a timer. It's on the screen, too. If we haven't had any problems recently, but if there is a problem, we'll just stop and pick up wherever we left off by reestablishing video. If that doesn't work, then by audio. But again, we haven't had any problems recently, so I expect smooth running this afternoon. So, Ms. McFarlane, do you want to save any time for rebuttal?
We had actually submitted a notice in advance since we have the student involved as well. So he's going to do the opening argument and reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, which I will do.
All right. Very good. All right, Mr. Cloward, then you get to start it off. You have 10 minutes. Try not to infringe on Ms. McFarlane's rebuttal time. It's not going to be easy in this case because there are a lot of issues. So I hope you've prioritized them. Take the most important ones first. All right, you may proceed. And introduce yourself to everybody, too, so they will know you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. And may it please the court, my name is Greg Cloward. I'm a law student at the UNLV Boyd School of Law, and I represent the appellant, James Ducey Perry. Your Honors, this case involves a high school educated man who was induced by his attorney spouse to sign a postnuptial agreement which fleeced him of all of his rights under the marriage. The agreement put the couple's real property into Maria's name, purported to waive any future rights to spousal support, and after 18 years of marriage, during which Maria's career and education took precedence, foreclosed any future claims James would otherwise have on her retirement benefits. After signing the agreement, the couple reconciled for a time and then lived separately for an additional 5.5 years, largely ignoring the terms of the agreement they had signed. When Maria finally filed this action, asking the Nevada courts to ratify the couple's agreement, she had earned a full military pension and was employed full-time as professional staff at the University of Nevada. In addition to her experience as an attorney, Maria was represented by counsel below. James, on the other hand, who moved to Nevada to fight for his family, was destitute. He lived in a homeless shelter throughout much of the proceedings below. At every opportunity where the trial court could have addressed this imbalance of power, it refused to do so. It rejected James's requests for temporary spousal support and for temporary attorney's fees. It expressed its desire to wrap up the proceedings as quickly as possible, stating as early as 3 months prior to trial, quote, "I don't want you to waste the time of the court when almost all of your case has already been decided." In an effort to bring the proceedings to a rapid close, the court exempted Maria from Rule 16.2's mandatory disclosures and limited discovery and trial to the issues of custody, visitation, and whether James could prove that he had been fraudulently induced into signing the agreement. On that issue, the court misapplied the burden of proof, placing it on James, when under both Nevada and Virginia law, it should have been Maria's burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the agreement was free of fraud or professional overreach. Having determined that James's testimony was not enough to meet the court's mistaken burden of proof, it incorporated the couple's agreement into its order in its entirety, save for on the issues of custody and visitation.
Mr. Cloward, I thought the district court didn't actually set the burden of proof. That was one area where it neglected its responsibility and simply ruled on the evidence that the evidence didn't show evidence of fraud in the inducement. But, you know, I'm jumping ahead, but I just wanted to see if you saw something else in the record.
No, I didn't, Your Honor. I think you're correct. The trial court did, however, throughout the proceedings of the hearing 3 months prior to trial, did expressly state that it was going to leave the issue of whether James had been induced to sign the agreement for trial, and that it was going to be that the agreement was going to govern the proceedings unless James could prove that he had been fraudulently induced into signing the agreement. So while the court might not have expressly set the burden of proof in writing upon James, that was how the proceedings played out below, so, and the court was very explicit.
You're referring to the pretrial then, which, of course, was in front of a different district judge than the trial proceedings were.
Yes, Your Honor, it was a different judge. However, the proceedings were still limited, according to that order, to visitation, custody, and the fraud issue. James was not allowed to put on any evidence at trial as to the actual terms of the agreement, or he was unable to demonstrate just how one-sided this agreement was because the trial was limited according to that prior order. Okay.
All right. Go ahead with the rest of your prepared argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I was going to, just as far as the introduction, note that the court did fail to apply Nevada statutory law as it came to custody and visitation, in failing to apply Nevada's statutory presumption that joint legal custody is in the best interest of the children, in failing to apply Nevada's statutory preference that joint physical custody is in the best interest of the children, in failing to set forth specific findings as facts as to the best interest of the children, and in failing to outline James's visitation rights with sufficient particularity. And for those reasons, Your Honors, we ask that this court set aside the couple's postnuptial agreement and remand for full proceedings below with instructions that James is to be on equal footing with Maria throughout. Your Honors, to my first point, under both Nevada and Virginia law, where a fiduciary duty exists and a transaction benefits the dominant party, courts examine that transaction with a higher degree of scrutiny. In Virginia, the transaction bears a presumption of fraud, and it is the dominant party's responsibility to rebut that presumption by clear and convincing evidence. Here in Nevada, The dominant party must prove by clear and satisfactory evidence that the agreement was free, was fundamentally fair, and free of professional overreach. The trial court should have applied this heightened level of scrutiny in this case because there is a fiduciary duty between the parties based on the fact of their marriage and on the fact that the couple had established already an attorney-client relationship in their past dealings. In both Nevada and Virginia, formality is not required to establish an attorney-client relationship. An attorney-client relationship can exist in spite of close familial relationship, and an attorney-client relationship can be established even if the attorney renders her services gratuitously. Additionally, in both states, marriage in and of itself gives rise to a fiduciary duty. And in Virginia, in fact, the courts have said that marriage is the highest fiduciary duty there is. So here we had a couple who had established an attorney-client relationship. Maria had, as the record shows, previously prepared legal documents for the couple's use, including powers of attorney. And we also had the fact that they were married. So as to whether the transaction benefited Maria, the dominant party, it clearly did on its face.
Let me interrupt you. I'm sorry. Chief Judge Gibbons, do you want to go first?
No, go ahead.
My question is, nothing in that agreement, though, prevented James from seeking legal advice before he signed it, right? That is correct,
Your Honor.
Okay, and finances would not have been an issue for him because under the agreement, as I understand it, he would have been provided a lawyer free of charge through the military. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And this I'm sorry. I apologize. Go ahead.
I'll let you ask. I apologize.
Oh, so did James even attempt to seek any type of legal counsel on the agreement before it was signed?
He testified that he did not, Your Honor. And this was an agreement that was drafted by an attorney who was representing an attorney. So, of course, it included this boilerplate language that it was in James's best interest to seek an attorney and that he ought to do that. But on the other hand, James testified that Maria was telling him that if he signed this agreement, as he had signed other legal documents that had been prepared by her in the past, the couple could reconcile, which is reflected in the record. They did, in fact, reconcile very shortly after signing this agreement. So Maria ought not to be let off the hook by the fact that this was a sound legal document and the fact that it included that boilerplate language when, in reality, that was not the way that the agreement was negotiated between the couple, if it was at all.
So, Mr. Cloward, then, again, you have limited time here, so I'll just try to get right to it. So if the court made a mistake and didn't actually state the standard correctly, in fact, it didn't state the standard at all other than there wasn't fraud, and the facts suggest that because these people lived a couple thousand miles apart and they'd already separated. She sent the agreement to him. She had a lawyer prepare it. He could have gotten a lawyer. He was under no pressure to sign it. He got it in Texas. He could do whatever he wanted. So where's the evidence that suggests there was any fraud other than the fact that she was a lawyer and they had done some dealings in the past when they were still together like a lawyer, but nothing similar to the present situation after they separated?
Maria should have had that burden to prove that this was fair professional overreach. The document on itself, on its face, is completely one-sided in favor of Maria. James received a couple of patents worth $0 and a 12-year-old car, whereas Maria received everything down to every last dime that the couple had in joint savings accounts. So we have the evidence before us. James or Maria would not be able to meet that burden because of how one-sided this document is. But again, James was prevented at trial from demonstrating how one-sided the document was because it was limited to whether he could prove that Maria had fraudulently induced him to sign the agreement.
Okay. So very quickly on the custody issue, since you're essentially out of time, what could you just summarize it as to why there was a problem with the way the court made its ruling on legal custody, physical custody, and the parenting time that James was ordered to have, but he didn't? It was never specified as to how he would have it.
Sure, Your Honor. As to custody, obviously there are the 12 best interest factors required by Nevada law. The court did not make specific findings as to those best interest factors. Under Lewis v. Lewis, a recent opinion by the Nevada Supreme Court, even if some of the findings can be categorized under those factors, that does not mean that the court properly set out and applied and complied with statute. As to visitation, Nevada law is clear that that visitation rights must be defined with sufficient particularity, and that the order cannot be subject to different interpretations by the parties. Here, giving Maria full discretion over his visitation obviously is very open to the different interpretations of the parties.
Okay, we'll have to leave it at that unless you have a concluding statement.
I was just gonna reserve the rest of the time for Ms. McFarling.
Okay, all right, so just over 4 minutes for her. All right, Mr. Fleeman, you've got the same problem here. There are a lot of issues in this case, and you have to prioritize. I'll leave it up to you as to how to do that.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Jack Fleeman for the respondent. May it please the court. At its heart, this case boils down to whether this court believes the district court erred in its determination that respondents, who I will refer to as James, willfully signed the party's marital settlement agreement with full knowledge that his wife, Maria, was not acting as his attorney at the time. From the plain language of the MSA and the evidence presented at trial, it seems more than clear that the district court made a proper determination and issued a decree that was based on substantial evidence. Despite this, as the court has noted, James challenges the district court's order and claims that there are at least 8 errors. I'll attempt to address each one of those errors as concisely as possible. With respect to the choice of law, while the district court applied Virginia law in the analysis of the validity of the enforcement of the MSA, James claims that it should have been Nevada law. That's what he argues in his briefs. James argues that Nevada law should have been applied because the rest of his arguments related to the validity of the MSA rely on that request. Nevertheless, there's nothing in the record to support the argument that Nevada law should have been applied. The plain language of the MSA states that it will be governed by Virginia law. Furthermore, James did not argue that Nevada law should be applied in the district court. James's reply brief claims that James did argue that, but the site that he provides is a pretrial hearing site that shows that James believes and asked if Nevada law could be applied. The district court at that hearing then immediately stated that Virginia law would be applied to the propriety of the MSA and asked if anyone disagreed. James was present. He did not respond to that question, did not disagree. James also argues that Virginia law should not be applied because Virginia has no substantial relationship to the parties because each party was a resident at the time of the divorce of Nevada, resident of Nevada, I apologize. That's a frivolous argument because Nevada had no connection to the parties at the time of the MSA, which is the only time frame that matters. In terms of the claim of a breach of fiduciary duty, this is kind of, I think, the most important argument that they're making, and so I think it's the most important one here. Regardless of the choice of law, James alleges that Maria owed him a fiduciary duty with regard to the MSA. His position is that because she was his wife and attorney, she owed him the fiduciary duty, and that he signed the agreement because he wasn't paying close attention because it was par for the course. James argues this because it impacts the burden of proof at trial, and as this court noted, the court below really didn't say what the burden of proof was. But it's important because under Virginia law, only if Maria were James's attorney or acting as James's attorney, then the MSA would be presumptively fraudulent. With all respect to counsel and Mr. Cloward, they're arguing that it's presumptively fraudulent before looking at the burden of proof and whether Virginia law applies and whether she was the attorney. It has to be determined whether she was acting as his attorney first, and that's what the court did. The court rejected James's claims and stated Maria did not draft the MSA. James presented no evidence Maria was representing him or had represented him in the capacity of an attorney in the past. He had presented no evidence of pressure or legal advice coming from her. The parties were separated, as the court noted. James made an interlineated change to the child support provision, which demonstrates he read the agreement and understood that he could modify the content. And most importantly, it's not boilerplate language, as counsel has stated. The language is the very first paragraph of the MSA in bold. I've never seen boilerplate language at the beginning that says, this is drafted by an attorney that only represents the other side. You're entitled to counsel, and you have a right to free counsel through the military. That's not boilerplate language. It's explicitly bolded, emphasized at the beginning, and James, according to his testimony, just claims that he didn't read that first paragraph, even though that he made interlineated changes throughout. The next part is about the argument of postnuptial agreement, which I don't think they argued just now, but the MSA is not void under Nevada law because it's a postnuptial agreement, as they claim. First of all, as I stated, Virginia law applies, not Nevada law. But even if Nevada law applies, the agreement is a separation agreement under NRS 123.080. It's not a postnuptial agreement. The parties were already separated, as this court pointed out. If the parties had not been separated or were not intending to separate, then it would be a postnuptial agreement that falls under the case of Cord v. Newhoff. But as it's an MSA, a marital separation agreement, they were allowed to include a waiver of spousal support. Again, that argument isn't necessary because Virginia law applies, but should the court believe that Nevada law would apply, it's the same outcome. So James's argument is that it was unfair, it was unequal, the court didn't apply the statutory factors. None of that comes into the analysis if Virginia law applies, and Virginia law does apply. The fact is the court found the MSA was valid under Virginia law. And under Virginia law, there was a full division, and under Nevada law even, there was a full division within the MSA. It divided all of the accounts. It divided and stated it divided Maria's IRA and military retirement, giving it solely to her. James, in his reply, cites to a case out of Virginia called Fox and says that he could not have waived the IRA or the military retirement because he didn't know it existed or know the specific amounts. That case is not relevant here. That case talks about implied waiver. It's inapplicable because James made an explicit waiver of his pension, of all the pensions and retirement, and specifically it's listed military retirement pay and IRAs under the plain language of the MSA. With regard to custody, Nevada law does apply the district court to the district court's determination. So this is where Nevada law should apply. However, it should be noted that the party's MSA, even though it's out of Virginia, granted Maria sole legal and primary physical custody, and that could not be ignored. The MSA reflected the agreement of the parties regarding what they believed to be in the best interest of their children. The district court properly found that the best interest of the children, in light of the MSA and the circumstances of the party since the MSA, required that Maria maintain sole legal and primary physical custody. Some of the findings that can be found in the court's order are that James testified that there was no time that Maria had not actually acted as the legal and physical custodian of the children over the past 6.5 years. So it was the status quo that the court was keeping, and it was James's testimony that she had always been the legal and physical custodian. The preference that James argues.
Let me ask you this. Since we're talking about the findings right now, you know, one of the purposes of having the district judge do findings like this in a family law case is there's a line in Nevada cases that says it's not just that the district court considered some of these factors and they look pretty good. There's actually a requirement that the district court has to show that it considered all of the factors. Now, there may be factors that don't apply to every individual case, but the district court has to include in its order some indication that we can see that it went through all of the statutory factors. And, you know, this order is written in kind of an unusual way. There's, you know, I can see what the district judge did. I can't remember if it's a he or a she, tried to make it kind of readable. So you have these long paragraphs that are kind of interesting to read, but it also makes it really hard to match up against the statute and figure out what finding relates to what statutory requirement. I'm just not sure how we're supposed to gather from this kind of narrative that all the factors have been considered.
I don't disagree with you. I don't think that the factors are spelled out or fleshed out in the order. I think it is necessary for anyone reading the order that was issued to look through and try to find the factors. And I don't disagree with the court that there is a line of case law that requires the court to actually go through and provide findings under each specific factor. That being said, I do believe that the summary of the evidence, the substantial evidence, does support the court's ultimate finding. As I stated, that primary physical custody and sole physical custody or legal custody should rest with mom.
Well, Mr. Doucette Perry, so you essentially agreed with what Mr. Fleeman, on behalf of Ms. Doucette Perry, you've agreed with Judge Talden essentially that the order doesn't comply with the cases from the Nevada Supreme Court. So you have to find some other way to support it. Is that correct?
Yes, I agree that it does not provide a specific analysis of each best interest factor.
Okay, so what about the very initial decision made pre-trial that the MSA wouldn't control, even though it had already set forth custody, and that was supposed to be a settlement of custody, but it was from 2013, and then the trial, you know, was many years later. Theoretically, can't you just put in the MSA that this is it, and we've agreed, we've settled this issue, we're done, we don't even have to get into custody at trial? Or does the court always have to get into custody because the best interest must be considered, the factors must be looked at, and particularly when there's a long delay, like in this case?
I believe that the court in Nevada is required to always review the party's agreement with respect to custody, and whether or not it does satisfy the best interest of the children. I think that's what the district court was trying to accomplish in this case by looking at the MSA and saying, look, in the MSA, which I'm not bound by, you've said you want sole legal with mom and primary physical custody with mom. Reviewing the circumstances and your performance since that time, it appears you've adopted this and still believe it's in the best interest of the children, and here's some evidence of that. You haven't paid child support. You haven't had any overnights with your kids. You acknowledge that mom's always had custody of the kids.
Is the situation any different at the time of trial since Mr. Duceppe Perry has moved to Reno at that point? He says he wants joint custody. He says he wants time with his kids. He's there for his kids, and so the situation's different. So now the court has to look at the present situation and project to the future and not just look at the past situation.
Well, I think the court did look at the present situation. Mr. Duceppe Perry had moved to Reno to answer the complaint in the divorce. When he moved to Reno, and this is in the record as well, he left his job in Texas. He had a car, and somehow that went away prior to the decree of divorce. But he lived in a homeless shelter for many months. He couldn't do any transportation of the kids. He still didn't have any stable housing when the trial occurred. He stated he didn't have any vehicle to transport the children. So the situation, although he was living in Reno, wasn't much different than it had been when he was living in Texas, except that he was closer in geography. He still wasn't exercising overnights or doing anything to evidence his request for joint physical custody. As the court found, my client, whenever Mr. Duceppe Perry had asked for visitation, she discussed it with him and he was given visitation. Those visits, as documented in the record, were basically him taking one of the children to go watch the NCAA tournament on television and things of that nature.
Right.
They weren't overnights. They weren't extended periods of time.
Mr. Fleeman, didn't he move into an apartment right before the trial started? And he also said he could arrange for transportation even though he didn't own a vehicle.
He mentioned that he could use a bus for transportation. I'm not sure that he gave a clear answer on how to get the kids to and from school. He testified that he had moved into an apartment, although I don't believe there was any other evidence of that, which I think is important because his credibility at the time of trial was determined, and the district court stated that he wasn't credible as a witness, which is the key here on appeal, because the district court, there's great deference given to the district court as to the party. So it was a bit self-serving at the time of trial for him to say, well, I can do these things, and yet prior to the trial, there's no evidence that he ever tried to with mom who was willing to work with him.
Mr. Fleeman, let me ask a question. Would you agree that the divorce decree does not lay out the parenting time schedule with any degree of particularity? You've been discussing some of the issues, but
right.
the decree
right. I don't fully agree with that because I do think that it lays it out with particularity in the sense that it gives mom discretion. The statute on whether visitation needs to be done with particularity, to my understanding, it is there so that you can enforce those types of agreements, so there's something that the court understands what this is when it reviews it on enforcement or modification.
Well, it's not atypical. Oh, I'm sorry. How are they doing parenting time right now? Are they following what they previously established in the MSA or?
My understanding is that he still requests what time he wants and he's given the time if they agree upon it. I don't think there's been any problems. I'm not aware of any motion filings or anything post record of the appeal.
Right, but Mr. Fleeman, really quick to follow up on what Judge Bullis said. Didn't both parties say that a plan could be put in place? And you can have a generalized plan. You can have teenage discretion. You can do various things. But right now, there's no plan. It's just in the discretion of mom. And she acts in good faith. There's nothing to suggest she doesn't. But the problem of enforceability is really tough because there's no specificity.
Right. The enforceability would have to be that if he believes that she's not acting in good faith or that there's a problem, that it should be modified or clarified to give him time. But that hasn't occurred, to my knowledge.
I mean, that's one of the funny things about contracts is really the purpose of writing contracts is for litigation. When things are going great, nobody needs a contract because nothing's going to end up in court. Written contracts of any kind, not just divorce decrees, but commercial contracts, they only matter when things go wrong. That's the point of having them, is for the situations when things go wrong. So the concern here is what you're telling us is things are going great. Well, if things are going great, you know, we wouldn't need this at all. But what happens when things go wrong? What does all this verbiage in here mean? And how is the court supposed to resolve this?
The remedy is a motion.
So let me ask you this. In paragraph 5, which is right after the timeshare, it says, Mr. Doucette Perry shall pay child support of $100 per month per child as requested by Ms. Doucette Perry. What does that even mean? Does that mean she's entitled to more? Does that mean is he paying $100? What's his requirement under that sense? Is he supposed to pay $100 a month, or is he not supposed to pay $100 a month? Does she cash for more?
My understanding is that she had requested the minimum amount, which at the time under the statute was $100 a month. So it's an order for $100 per month in child support.
So it doesn't really
make much sense with multiple children, but I think she was waiving the remainder.
You're reading the sentence to me and he's paying $100 a month, and the rest of the sentence as requested by Mrs. Doucette Perry, you're saying that means that that's what she asked for at trial, or are you saying that he only has to pay $100 a month when he's asked to pay $100 a month?
It says the beginning of the first day of July, Mr. Doucette Perry shall pay $100 per month per child as requested. I think that's her request at trial, and that she may request the court to review the non-statutory amount after December 2019. My understanding of that is she had requested an amount lower than the statutory minimum. The court was granting that because it was essentially a waiver of, you know, her right to the subject request, come back, ask for a modification December 2019, because the understanding was that he was going to have gainful employment and be making more money at that point potentially.
Okay. And did she also waive all the past due child support since he hadn't been paying it for these many years?
That's my understanding, is that there was no issue of the arrears.
Okay. So there were still two children, minor children, in the home. So you're indicating the absolute minimum should have been $200 a month unless the court made findings to allow the court to go underneath it.
Correct. The court should have made a finding under Rivero and Fernandez and that line of cases that the amount was in the best interest of the children and that it was sufficient to meet the needs of the children.
Okay. But obviously he's not appealing that issue because he didn't have to. He paid less than the minimum. So, and she's,
right.
She's not appealing because she asked for it.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Very good job explaining these points, particularly since you were not the trial attorney, Mr. Fleeman. And we'll move on now to the rebuttal argument from Ms. McFarling.
Good afternoon. Emily McFarling appearing on behalf of the appellant. We're asking today for you to reverse and remand many, many different parts of the court's orders for quite a few different reasons. And the orders begin from this agreement that the parties had prepared and signed a long time ago, but we have so many different elements that stem from it that get us to where we are today. On the property and debt division and alimony issues, you have two options for where you can go with that you find that this agreement wasn't properly handled in the district court. And as we heard earlier, there are a lot of different ways that it was not handled properly. Respondent argued that the heart of this is that you have to find that James signed with full knowledge that Maria was not acting as his attorney. That's not the standard here. We have these cases out of Virginia that are very clear and set a very high burden on Maria to have to have this agreement upheld when it finally does come to court. And she just simply can't meet that burden.
Ms. McFarland, can you point us to any evidence in the record that suggests there was fraud in the inducement other than they were married and that she was a lawyer?
Here's the problem with that question and being asked that at this point in time. James was not allowed to do full discovery. He was not allowed to do much of anything to prepare for trial. He was constantly told that the burden was placed on him by several different judges. And even though there were different judges, how they handled this case was very similar to each other. And at trial, he wasn't given that opportunity or even informed that that was something that he could argue. So
well, the discovery,
while there isn't a very extensive record on it,
the discovery order clearly allowed him to pursue evidence on this issue of fraud in the inducement. So he was not restricted in any way. And even if he did no discovery, couldn't he just come into court and explain the circumstances about why he believed that she was his lawyer at that moment in time, even though he was in Texas, they were separated, and she was in Virginia?
In a perfect world, yes, but the problem with this case is that there were so many mistakes and so many ways that he was disadvantaged leading up to that point that there's no way that he possibly could have even been prepared to put on that case. You say, yeah, he was allowed to do discovery, but he had admissions that he asked and they weren't answered, and he tried to get remedy from that from the court. And he wasn't. So even though, yeah, he technically was allowed to do discovery in the discovery order, he wasn't. And they didn't allow him to actually get the discovery when he brought it before the court. So it was lip service on him even having that limited right to discovery on that limited issue.
Well, let me ask you this as a practical matter, okay? In a corporate case, a commercial contract case, you allege fraud. I can imagine all kinds of discovery you'd want to get. Emails from the CEO to the vice president. You want to get, you know, emails from the sales rep, all the kind of stuff. This is a contract between two people, a husband and a wife. What discovery are you talking about? She's not going to have documents. She doesn't have meeting minutes. There's no corporate charter. I mean, what discovery are you talking about as a practical matter in terms of evidence that she defrauded him?
I mean, the problem with this case is I don't know the answer to that because he wasn't allowed to really go down that road, not just because of the limited discovery, but because of him constantly being told that he had the burden to prove that. And so there isn't the information isn't in the record sufficient for me to comment on it or for you to make a determination. That's why this case needs to be reversed and remanded, either with this agreement found void or for further proceedings where it is very clear who has the burden, that there can be full discovery done, and that the proceedings are handled correctly. And if that happens, then he should be able to present that. In addition, on making sure that he can put on a proper case when the court reviews temporary orders for preliminary fees or for spousal support, this court should direct that they have to take into account that these parties need to be able to come to court on an equal footing. One of the huge problems is just that huge disparity in an attorney who had an attorney and an indigent man who has no representation at all to even be able to put on a case on a complex legal issue.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Ms. McFarland. You ended up getting your 5 minutes that you had reserved. And you're fighting hard. You're fighting hard for him. I mean, obviously, there's a problem on the surface because of what you just said. And so we will have to grapple with that. And you did your usual excellent work. And you had quite a co-counsel there today. So hopefully this is the start of a long career for Mr. Clower. You got to finish law school first, but it'll go on. And then you're up against a very tough opponent who you know very well, both working in Clark County, even though this was a Washoe County case. So, Mr. Fleeman, you did a great job, too. So we appreciate the efforts from all of you here today. This matter will be taken under submission for a written decision, hopefully in the near future. And Judge Tao and Judge Bulla, do you have any concluding comments?
Just, we've had occasional briefs that were written or assisted in by UNLV students, but this is the first time that I can recall that a UNLV student actually argued in front of us. And I just want to say this is an interesting experience. I hope you got a lot out of it, and hopefully this will inspire you to, in the future, do more arguments, maybe take some pro bono cases so you get more arguments when you're licensed.
Absolutely. Thank you, Your Honor.
I would agree. And Mr. Cloward, I thought you just did a very nice job at handling the questions that were posed to you and offering explanations. It was helpful for all of us. So thank you. And I want to thank Ms. McFarland and Mr. Fleeman for all your good work. And it was just a very nice argument. Thank you both.
Right, Ms. McFarland, just imagine if you'd been the trial counsel instead of the appellate counsel.
That would have made a huge difference, I think.
Thank you for taking this case on appeal, and thanks again to all of you for an excellent argument.
Right, and Mr. Fleeman, if you had written the post-trial decree. All right, we look forward to seeing all of you again. We will be in recess.